This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Last week, Boston became that rare U.S. city to elect a union man to the mayor's office.
State representative, now mayor-elect, Marty Walsh's labor ties were a big issue in the campaign. His opponent, John Connolly, and other critics asked if he could be truly independent of the city's unions.
That question lingers, but the full implications of Walsh's election for the city and the U.S. labor movement are just starting to come into focus. WBUR's David Scharfenberg reports.
Richie Rogers sits in a modest meeting room at the downtown headquarters of the Greater Boston Labor Council, an umbrella group for 161 unions. On a whiteboard behind him, a list of agenda items from a recent meeting. One reads simply, Mayor, with a big exclamation point. It's just 2 days since Marty Walsh, a longtime labor leader, won election as Boston's first new mayor in a generation, and Rogers is riding high.
People don't understand this, that yesterday tens of thousands of workers went to work in the city of Boston, walking tall with their head high, all over the city, in hotels, hospitals, on construction sites. The extraordinary fervor for Martin, I've never seen anything like it, to be honest with you, in my 30 years of the labor movement.
The Labor Council deployed thousands of volunteers to knock on doors and make phone calls on Walsh's behalf. But it wasn't just local union interests involved in this race. American Working Families, a political action committee registered in Virginia and at least partially funded by unions, spent almost $1.1 million on TV ads. And Working America, a project of the national AFL-CIO, spent $660,000 on a mail and canvassing campaign run out of a Holiday Inn in South Boston. Karen Nussbaum, the group's executive director, says the Boston election brought together Walsh's personal charisma and a city with a long labor history.
Well, that's a powerful combination. It is by no means unique, and I think we'll be seeing more Marty Walsh's all around the country.
Walsh's victory comes as labor is in crisis. Just 11.3% of American workers are unionized, the lowest rate in nearly a century. That's got labor leaders scrambling for new approaches. One strategy, shifting their focus away from a gridlocked Washington and toward local candidates and local issues. The movement is also trying to forge more alliances with Black and Latino activists and white progressives, like it did in the Boston mayor's race.
You're seeing at the city level in particular efforts to mobilize coalitions, broad-based coalitions, as you saw here in Boston.
That's Tom Cochen, a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management.
So that's where the energy is going, and I think it's a sensible strategy.
Still, whatever its residual clout in urban America, the labor movement has elected very few of its own to big city mayoralties. The one exception, Antonio Villaraigosa, a former union organizer who served as mayor of Los Angeles from 2005 until this past summer. His tenure offers something of a cautionary tale for union leaders. Faced with the Great Recession, Villaraigosa says he had to break with the unions, slashing city jobs and trimming pensions.
There were times where I just had to say that, you know, I'm supportive when their interests coincide with the public and the common interest, and when they don't, you know, I had to make the tough calls, and we did.
Rafe Sonenshine, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles, says relations got particularly testy with the teachers' union, Villaraigosa's former employer.
It's pretty hard to be mayor of the city and not get involved in the schools. At this point, the expectation is pretty high that the mayor will do something about the schools.
That expectation will be particularly high in Boston, where education was the top issue in the mayor's race. But Walsh is promising to work with the Boston Teachers Union, to trade on his trust with organized labor to get things done. Richard Stutman, president of the union, says he can negotiate with Walsh on thorny issues like extending the school day.
I would bet you, whatever you want to bet, that there is more likelihood of getting an extended day under a collegial, cooperative mayor than there is under a hard-nosed, my-way-or-the-highway type of a guy.
That, supporters say, is the promise of the Walsh administration. Cast as an incrementalist in the mayor's race, less disruptive, less visionary than his opponent, he has a chance to do something creative with union contracts. Walsh will have some early opportunities. Departing Mayor Tom Menino is locked in a contract dispute with the Boston Police Patrolmen's Union that could bleed into Walsh's tenure and hit the city with millions in unexpected costs. And he'll face a tough and closely scrutinized negotiation with the firefighters who campaigned for him in the mayor's race.
Well, I think that'll be, you know, the big test.
That's Sam Tyler, president of the business-backed Boston Municipal Research Bureau, a fiscal watchdog. Tyler, who serves on Walsh's transition team, says escalating contracts for police and fire are making it harder for the mayor of Boston to invest elsewhere, to put his vision in place in the parks or libraries.
I think what we'll see is that there, over time, this is not something that will necessarily happen all at once, but over time we'll see fewer employees in other departments.
Union leaders insist they understand the management pressures Walsh will face. They say they're just looking forward to a chief executive who truly understands and respects the labor movement. Harris Grumman with the Massachusetts wing of the Service Employees International Union says organized labor can build the middle class in Marty Walsh's Boston, just as it did in the America of the 1950s and 60s. And the union movement, he says, must articulate that promise in the heat of political campaigns.
We have a proud history, and what we need to do is communicate why it is a proud history and why it's a positive thing. And if we fail to do that, well, then, you know, we deserve to lose.
If the Boston mayor's race was a referendum on the labor movement, then the labor movement won. It was close, but for union leaders, that narrow victory is a big one.
That story from WBUR's David Scharfenberg.
As we all know, the Red Sox season ended in a blaze of glory, but the larger world of sports goes on. So with us to talk not just baseball, but also some football and basketball, is Bill Littlefield, the host of NPR's Only a Game, who joins us in the studio. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Sasha.
Hey, Bill. So let's start with what's probably going to be our last chance, maybe, to talk about the Red Sox until spring training.
Nonsense. The Hot Stove League is just heating up.
Okay, so much of Boston and this region might regard John Farrell as manager of the year, but the American League begs to disagree. Yesterday, the league awarded Cleveland Indians manager and former Red Sox manager Terry Francona the title of Manager of the Year for 2013. He received 16 first place votes to Farrell's 12. Here he is speaking yesterday on ESPN.
Oh boy, I think we managed to do it together, which was probably the only way. And it's a very fulfilling way. A lot of the guys got a taste of winning and what it can be like, and I think we'll all come back next year a little hungrier.
So I like John Farrell, but nice to hear Terry Francona there. What's your response?
Well, the last time I looked, you didn't get a great big gaudy diamond-studded ring for being named Manager of the Year. So probably John Farrell is not too disappointed at this point. And you have to take into account not only that this voting takes place based on the regular season before the postseason begins, but also that it's baseball writers.
Yeah.
Are doing the voting. And people have all kinds of, axes to grind and different ways of looking at things. And it's also very difficult for me to feel badly about any election where Terry Francona winds up on top. He went through some awful things at the end of his career, terrible stuff that people were saying and writing about him they had no business doing.
You mean his career here in Boston?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Private stuff that was coming out that, you know, was a bad thing. So, good on him.
It's worth mentioning, too. So the Indians won 92 games. The Red Sox under Farrell won 97 games. But Cleveland did it with essentially half the payroll.
Yeah,
right?
Small market team, absolutely. Yeah. And a pleasant team. I had a chance to spend some time with the Indians last year early in the season, and a very nice bunch of guys.
All right. So overall, the American League, you think they made the right choice?
Sure. I can go along with that.
All right.
Bill, a football question. This one has to do with sports leadership. The head coach of the Miami Dolphins, Joe Philbin, has been taking a lot of heat about what's been going on in that team's locker room. That 24-year-old rookie lineman, Jonathan Martin, who left the team after allegedly being bullied by his teammate, Richie Incognito. The accusation that Martin makes is that Incognito, quote, did harassment that went far beyond the traditional locker room hazing, like vulgar voicemails and racial slurs sent via text message. The Dolphins' owner, Stephen Ross, plans to meet with Jonathan Martin today, and here he is speaking on ESPN yesterday.
I'm really disturbed by it. I mean, you know, because I really care about the Miami Dolphins, I care about the players, I care about Jonathan Martin, and I care about our fans. And to hear these type of charges, you know, and being part of that, it's something I can't really live with.
So bullying in the NFL, but what's your perspective on this?
Well, it's Incognito did is inexcusable. What Martin has done may be heroic, which is to stand up in the face of this and say, you know what, I don't have to take this. And I don't know the particulars any more than anybody else who wasn't in the locker room does. there is a tendency for a certain number of people in a pro locker room, whether it's football, baseball, whatever it might be, to be in a state of arrested adolescence. And it's a state in which throwing around four-letter words and insults and comparing men to women with a derogatory slant on women is simply the currency, the language of the place. And it's unfortunate. It's especially unfortunate because people outside the locker room pay attention to it. Dolphins fans at the game last weekend were holding up the most insulting, ridiculous, adolescent, puerile signs that I've ever seen in a pro sports stadium. And that's saying something. So it's all incredibly unfortunate, but unhappily not entirely unexpected.
On the point of the signs you said you saw, I mean, there are many people defending Richie Incognito. There were people holding signs saying free Incognito.
Yeah. I mean,
that was a much more G-rated sign than you saw. But
yeah.
What do you make of the defense?
What I make of the defense is there are a certain number of people who value toughness, especially as it's exhibited in its lowest possible form, as long as it's exhibited by somebody else. I mean, they're all for people going out there and beating the tar out of each other, because when you're sitting in the stands, there's very little chance that anybody's going to beat the tar out of you.
You talked about a currency, a sort of locker room currency. Do you think this is regular locker room behavior throughout the NFL?
Not to the extent that it's been evident in this instance, no. I think the insulting, the threats to kill somebody's family members, this is way, way, way beyond the bounds of kidding, hazing. It's gone way past that point.
That's WBUR's and NPR's Bill Littlefield, the host of Only a Game. You can hear it every Saturday at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.